National News.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the February 9th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. The global coronavirus pandemic has played havoc with international sports and their schedules. Just one example, the Boston Marathon, the world's oldest annual marathon, has been held annually since 1897. But last year, it was canceled for the first time due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Boston Marathon is traditionally held the third Monday of April, but this year's race has been pushed back and is now tentatively scheduled for October 11th. The Boston Athletic Association says the date is contingent on road races being allowed as part of the reopening plan in the Northeast U.S. state of Massachusetts. Boston Marathon race director Dave McGillivray has been the lead organizer of the big race for decades. But now Dave is involved in another big race, the race to deliver the COVID-19 vaccine to residents of Massachusetts. And Dave took a break from his busy schedule to chat with the energetic Andy Edwards about the vaccine program. Here's Andy.
Dave, welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Andrew, very honored to be on the show. And I've heard about you from Catherine Switzer so much. So it's just a pleasure to be with you here today.
Right then. Let me give you a little phrase, because what I'd like to start with is what you, okay, race director of Boston Marathon, but your company, DMSE, put on events. Now you're organizing something very different. And I have in mind that I heard somebody, a medical director of another big marathon, say, remember, this was with view of people taken ill on a race. When you have a big marathon, you have a fairly sized, quite big town on the move, 30 to 50,000 people. And so one, if somebody's taken ill, it's not a huge surprise, but also you have to be ready. Now your company, you'll give us more details, from what I know, is organizing the vaccination against COVID-19 for the state of Massachusetts. Now, how do the qualities you need for Boston Marathon, you and your colleagues, how do they switch to this massive vaccination campaign?
Really good question. And for us, you know, I've been putting on events for over 40 years, 1,300 events. And with COVID coming along, all 35 of my events last year went over the cliff. I always thought this industry of ours was bulletproof, but I was proven wrong. So we had to pivot in the word of the year. And we started doing all different types of things like drive-in movies and COVID testing sites and outdoor graduations and virtual events. But then that all went away in the wintertime. And we're looking at each other saying, now what do we do? And we got an opportunity from this company called CIC Health here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was hired by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to be the provider of two mass vaccination sites, one at Gillette Stadium and one at Fenway Park in Boston. And they said, hey, we need some logisticians. I didn't even know I was a logistician, but they said, we need operations people. We need people who know how to move people and how to do them in a safe and efficient manner. So they tapped into us and they said, would you be interested? I said, there's not a lot going on other than us just trying to figure out how we're going to keep a pulse. So we signed up, and putting on a marathon is very similar to what they're asking us to do. And that is, the first thing is you go to the venue and it's visualization, it's conceptualization. It's like thousands of people show up. How do we get them from point A to point B in a safe an efficient manner. So we started thinking about all that, laying out the venue, and just figuring out how we would make this all happen. Because the key to this is to keep everyone safe and to vaccinate as many people as possible. So you can't have hiccups. You got to know what you're doing and have that vision. And that's what we do for these vaccination sites.
Couple of questions. Firstly, what sort of workforce in numbers do you have? And also, I've read comments in the American press that you've been set an aim of 7,000 vaccinations a day. And if I stick in a third question, some of the vaccination venues, like the home of the Boston Red Sox in baseball, and the New England Patriots in American football, NFL. I mean, these are halcyon names to those of us outside USA, but who are well aware of American sports. So how many people you got? What's the turnover in terms of vaccination and venue?
Yeah, good question. First of all, just like putting on a marathon, it's a team effort. You know, you just don't have two or three people doing this. So you collaborate with a lot of different organizations. We have the clinical people from hospitals and ambulance companies. We have security people from the venue itself. We have the DMSE people. We have the CIC health people. So we've never worked together. So that was the first, not challenge, but that was our first thing we had to learn what each other's respective skill sets were, so we could collaborate and make sure this all goes smooth. So there's literally hundreds and hundreds of people involved in this, especially the vaccinators. So if we have 50 vaccination stations set up, and we have what's called tack time, which means how long it takes for someone to get to the station, get vaccinated, and move on their way, so that we can schedule these appointments throughout the day so there's no backup, there's no lines, things of that nature, and delays. So there's hundreds of people involved in the overall process. In terms of numbers, again, you start small and you ramp up. That's what we did. Started with like 100 people a day, then 500 people a day, and then 1,500 and 2,000, and now we're up to 3,000 a day at Gillette Stadium. Eventually, we'll get to 5 in the next week or so, and then 7, then 8, and then 10. So, and then as the weather gets better, we'll probably move the operation outside and do drive-through vaccination. So that might be able to get us more bandwidth to do more people in a period of time. We're actually working 10 hours a day, 7 days a week at both of those venues. And now we're being asked to open up other mass vaccination sites throughout the Commonwealth. So this is a massive, massive effort. But everyone, you know, again, what this is all about for us is keeping people healthy, keeping people alive, and we're actually bringing back our own industry in the process.
I think that's a very good point because, okay, it's true of many areas of, well, athletics, road running, you could say the entertainment industry, hospitality industry, people who go out and put on a show, whether you're a comedian, musician, race director, or indeed professional runner or mass runner. I wondered, part of the skill set for all the people working with you, does tact and diplomacy come into it? Because I have to say, personally, I had my first COVID jab yesterday in London, and the atmosphere was great. Smooth, smooth process, and everybody behaved well to each other. But and maybe those who are going for the jab want it, so they're going to behave well. But you do read of stories, you know, that people have been under a great deal of pressure, and sometimes the emotions burst out. Do you need that kind of diplomacy as well?
It's not just about the actual technical part and technician part of the process, but it's about the overall experience. And when you look at, Andrew, like a marathon, you have the elite athletes up front, you have the age groupers in the middle, and you have the slower runners on the backside. So you have three different groups and who have different needs and expectations. Well, it's the same with this. Right now, we're dealing with the 75 plus age group individuals. So they have special needs. A lot of them are coming in wheelchairs or, you know, they have their walkers. So the time to get them through the system now is very different than the first group we had, which were the first responders. So as we go through all this, we're learning too. And your point is very well taken that diplomacy is really important. And we also know that there are people, even though they're excited about getting the vaccination, they're also nervous. So upon arrival, we want to put them at ease. We want them to know that we're going to take care of them. And then once they have the vaccination, they have to go to the observation area and we have to watch over them. Just like running a marathon, you cross the finish line. We just don't say, okay, leave the system. We just, the medical people are there making sure everyone's okay. If you need medical assistance, we're right there. And once you're good, you feel good and everyone's safe, then they can be on their way. Exact same thing.
How do you see this process continuing? I mean, have you been given a contract to say, we want you to run the vaccination, not ad infinitum, but is there a closing date, say, right, you know, August something, your job is done?
Well, there's an expectation. Nobody knows. We don't have that crystal ball that says on this day we're done. A lot of it has to do with the production of the vaccine. You know, how many different companies now are producing it? It all depends on the delivery schedule of the vaccine. We know that there are X amount of people in the state of Massachusetts, whether it's 6 million or whatever that number is. So it's our, not just our singular goal, but there's vaccination sites all over the state. So we're just the largest ones. And we're going to just keep doing it until we've vaccinated everybody who wants to be vaccinated. So our timeline kind of shows us somewhere in the latter part of the summer. So we're actually looking at a 6 to 8 month program. But what's good about that for us is that we're also looking at our events coming back, hopefully, in the fall. For example, the Boston Marathon has been rescheduled from April to October 11th. Well, my hope is that we'll be able to produce the Boston Marathon, and we're helping ourselves in that process by doing this vaccination program to help us get us to that point where we can finally have live in-person events again.
That's Dave McGillivray, the race director of the Boston Marathon. And Dave was talking from Boston with the energetic Andy Edwards in London. And we'll hear more of Dave and Andy's conversation later this week.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
In African football, Morocco beat Mali Sunday 2-0 to win its second consecutive African Nations Championship, or CHAN, title. Football commentators are praising the overall performance of teams from East Africa at the CHAN tournament, which featured African players who ply their trade in their domestic leagues. Magume Davis Rakawinj filed this report from Kampala, Uganda.
East Africa was represented by Uganda, Tanzania, and Rwanda. The two East Africans, Rwanda and Uganda, were pulled in the same Group C alongside defending champions and eventual winners, Morocco, while Tanzania was in Group D that had Guinea, Zambia, and Namibia. Tanzania was honorably eliminated at group stages after managing a win and a draw to amass 4 points, just 1 point less than Guinea and Zambia in Group D, while Rwanda held eventual winners Morocco 0-0, drew against rivals Uganda, and beat Togo 3-2 to qualify for their second quarterfinal at the CHAN tournament. James Munyaneza, a Rwandan sports analyst, describes Rwanda's performance against Togo as the highlight of the tournament.
They didn't lose any of those two first matches. And then they went ahead and actually defeated the other opponent, Togo. Here Rwanda comes and falls behind first, then he recovers, scores, then goes behind again, then again recovers, and then go on to win the game 3-2. That was a fantastic outcome. But overall, the performance in that game was really incredible. The boys were confident. They played aggressive attacking football from the start to the end.
Tanzanian reporter Daniel Mulimuka was equally impressed by the Mavubi exploits at the tournament.
I expected Uganda to do more, more so because of the reputation they have in African football. Their 5-2 defeat against Morocco was even worse. They failed to progress to another stage. Rwanda surprised me a little bit. I should say they were like the dark horses of the tournament. they were able to break the barrier and reach the quarterfinals. And Tanzania had not a very good performance, but not very bad performances, because they were an inch close to going or progressing to the knockout stage.
Ahmed Hussein, the spokesperson of Federation for Uganda Football Associations, also praises the level of competition at the tournament.
The way the teams organized themselves for the tournament, the kind of football that was played. When you look at a team like Morocco, I think they've improved from what they achieved in 2018. They have defended the title, and the kind of football showed on the pitch shows you exactly how much they prepared for this tournament. Yes, there are countries like Uganda. We had almost a one-month preparation. We had high hopes of getting out of the group stages, but this didn't happen. But we lost to eventual champions, and that is Morocco.
All the pundits here praise hosts Cameroon for the good job done. Patrick Kanyomozi is the head of Uganda Sports Press Association.
It was important in terms of giving hope to the football fraternity across the continent, because most of the activities were halted because of the pandemic, and they returned slowly in a number of countries. For some other countries, it's been hard enough for them too. So it's a ray of hope for the footballers across the continent that if competitions can be played at such a high level, and then there's hope for the game as Africa, most parts of Africa, wait for the COVID-19 vaccination. And it should be a good focus point, especially going into the qualifiers, which are also being played under totally different circumstances, and that's qualifiers for both the Africa Cup of Nations and the 2022 World Cup. It was a good tournament, a ray of hope for football.
Indeed, the tournament had outstanding performers from East Africa, with Rwanda defender Fitina Ombolenga being selected in the tournament's first 11, and impressive Ugandan midfielder Said Cheyune, Uganda's best performer at the tournament, getting a contract to Sudanese giants El Melik after his remarkable two long-range goals against Togo and Morocco. For the Sunday Side of Sports, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala.
Thanks, Magume. Meanwhile, the Atlas Lions of Morocco get a Sunny Side of Sports salute for their trophy-winning Chan performance. In an interview with Iron Mike Mbonye, African football analyst Sammy Wajia said the Moroccans were clearly the best team in Cameroon.
Well, you have to say Morocco are deserved champions of the African Nations Championships for 2020, even though the competition was played in 2021, obviously, no thanks to the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic. Morocco were absolutely peerless in the tournament. In the group stages, they won all but one of their games. The only blemish they had was during their second game against Rwanda. They just about failed to get a win. They dominated that game, but it finished 0-0. The other two games in the group against Togo, they won by a goal to nil, and they also won in emphatic fashion against Uganda by 5-2 in their decisive and last preliminary game. And I think that's where the Moroccans clicked into gear. In the quarterfinal, they faced the Chipolopolo of Zambia. They won that one quite easily by 3-1. And what a matchup in the semifinals. They were up against the host nation, Cameroon. It was pretty much the final against the final. But Morocco sent a statement to the rest of the continent. It was a statement of intent. And they won that game by 4-0 in Limbe on the 3rd of this month. So it was pretty much expected that they were going to win that final match against Mali in Yaoundé. They won it by 2-0. So, like I said, I mean, the results of Morocco showed that they were by far and away the best team, the most complete team in the tournament, and they've retained their title. I don't think anyone can begrudge them or say they do not deserve that title.
Four Moroccan clubs made it to the semi-finals of the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup last year. Is this victory a sign of dominance of North African teams in the continent?
Yeah, four clubs, like you said, reached the semi-finals of the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup semi-finals last year. And to be honest, I think that's a sign of the dominance that Moroccan football has as far as African football is concerned. And they've carried that dominance to the season as well. Three clubs from Morocco have reached the latest stages of the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup. In the CAF Champions League, which is at the group stages at the moment, one Moroccan club has reached that stage, with that Athletic Casablanca. This is a club with great pedigree as far as African football is concerned. And you have to say that they are one of the two favorites to progress to the next stage of the competition, because when you look at the clubs that they will face in the group, Horoya from Guinea, Petro de Luanda from Angola, and the South African club Kaizer Chiefs, you have to say Wydad are favorites not just to qualify, but to qualify as winners of that particular group. And talking about Moroccan clubs dominating on the African continent, two Moroccan clubs have reached the playoff round of the CAF Confederation Cup. They are Tihad Athletic Sports do Casablanca, who I see as a rising force on the continent. And there's also another club from Morocco doing wonderful things as far as the CAF Confederation Cup is concerned. They've also, just like the club I mentioned earlier, reached the playoff stage of the competition. I'm talking about none other than Raja Athletic do Casablanca, a side that needs absolutely no introduction as far as African football is concerned. So yes, Moroccan clubs are doing extremely well on the continent. You have to say props to them. They are certainly one of the dominant forces as far as African football is concerned.
It's been reported that some players who participated in this edition of CHAN have been picked by European clubs. What's your take on this move?
The news has been all over the place that some players that participated with their respective countries at the African Nations Championships have gotten deals to play with European clubs. I think this is absolutely fantastic. It's what it is. We want African football to thrive. We want the best players from Africa playing on the continent. But when you look at the economic situation, and realistically speaking, come on, most African, if not all African players currently doing the business, playing their trade on the continent, will want to at some stage play in Europe, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, players from sub-Saharan Africa. So it's really good news, I'll say, that players who participated and just concluded CHAN have gotten a chance to strut their stuff abroad, especially in Europe. And let us also not forget that the African Nations Championship, from inception, is a tournament that exclusively features players who are active in the national championships and qualify to play in the ongoing season. Expatriate players, regardless of where they play, even in Africa, are not qualified to take part in the tournament. And if you ask many players, especially those in sub-Saharan Africa and some in North Africa, what their long and short-term ambitions are from this perspective, they will all tell you that they want to go to Europe. You know, so, I mean, it is what it is. The fact that some African players have still deals to play abroad is very positive news indeed.
That's African football analyst Sammy Wajia. And Sammy spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Port Harcourt, Nigeria.
Sporty greetings. This is Sammy Wajia, Port Harcourt-based sports analyst. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Turning to tennis, Spanish star Rafa Nadal was one of the winners during Tuesday's second day of action at the Australian Open. Craig Gabriel reports from Melbourne.
Rafa Nadal is still concerned about his back. He's been worried about it for the last week, but in his match, he didn't seem to be hampered. Nadal appeared to be moving relatively freely as he defeated Laszlo Djere 6-3, 6-4, 6-1. The Spaniard said it's a day-to-day proposition. Now, it's common knowledge how particular Nadal is when he's on court, the little tics and mannerisms that he has. So he was asked if the pandemic has thrown out his routines.
People think that I am a very routine guy because I do all these routines on court. But outside of the court, I am completely the opposite. No, I am not a very organized guy. With the pandemic, I don't know. I have been at home.
Well, there were no idiosyncrasies with the world number one, Ash Barty. The popular Australian took 44 minutes to record a double bagel.
Yeah, that's the challenge for me, is to almost, when I wanted to go out there and almost take the sting, kind of take the pepper out of the match a little bit and get it on my terms as much as possible right from the get-go and make it feel like she had a real mountain to climb. And I think that was probably the most pleasing overall, is that right from the start I set the tone and was able to run away with it.
Danka Kovanic was looking for a hole to crawl into on the Rod Laver Arena. The defending women's champion, Sophia Kennan, has been talking about nerves the past week. She won her match, but it was far from a good effort. Daniil Medvedev was untroubled, but the 12th seed, Victoria Azarenka, was upset by American Jessica Pegula. And the 13th men's seed, David Goffin, was also beaten. He was upset by Aussie Alexei Poprin, who came back from 2-1 down, 4 match points down, and a breakdown in the 5th, 3-6, 6-4, 6-7, 7-6, 6-3. Also scoring wins were Alex Diminor, Stefanos Tsitsipas, and Garbine Muguruza. Craig Gabriel for VOA Sports, Melbourne.
Thanks, Craig. In more football news, Manchester United will host West Ham Tuesday evening in a FA Cup fifth-round match. VOA's Gwen Uden has this preview for us. Sporty greetings, Gwen!
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Manchester United are currently in second place in the Premier League, just 5 points behind leaders Manchester City. But Man United must turn their attention to the FA Cup on Tuesday, when they will host West Ham for a spot in the quarterfinals. Man United suffered a disappointing exit in the semifinal stage of competition last season and are looking to do better this time around. Manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer spoke on MUTV ahead of Tuesday's match and said this season his ultimate goal is to lift a trophy.
You want to win every single competition, FA Cup, Europa League, every game you play, the Premier League. So, and that's the ultimate challenge and a test for a team to go all the way. We've improved. We've had a plan in place, and I think the team is getting better and better. Last season semi-final, disappointing to lose that one, of course, and you want to go all the way and you want to lift the trophy.
So far this season, Man United have fared better on the road than in their last two home games. Nonetheless, Solskjaer says he's grateful his side is able to play at Old Trafford on Tuesday with the quarterfinals on the line.
I think we're finding our way to score goals, create chances at home as well. So we're happy that we don't have to travel. Wish we had our fans behind our back, of course, but I'd rather play here than in London.
West Ham are currently sixth in the Premier League and have exceeded many people's expectations this season. And West Ham's hopes of an FA Cup title were given a bit of a boost when Man United midfielder Paul Pogba suffered an injury last Sunday. He will reportedly be out for several weeks. But while Pogba's injury might be seen as an advantage for West Ham, Solskjaer says his upcoming opponents were already enjoying a remarkable run on their own.
They've improved a lot, I have to say. David's got his team really well organized, as he always does with his teams, and he's got some very good players, and of course Jesse did really well for them, and I hope he's gonna make them a better team, because that means he'll have played well.
West Ham have won the FA Cup title 3 times, the last time in 1980, and have been runners-up twice. Meanwhile, Manchester United have appeared in the FA Cup final on 19 occasions and have lifted the FA Cup trophy 12 times, making them the second most successful team in the competition behind Arsenal. And Solskjaer hopes a win on Tuesday will put them on course to lift their first FA Cup trophy since 2016.
To get to a final, sometimes you're lucky with a draw, but to win a final, then all the good teams have been beaten. So that's the next step for us in the development of this team, is to go all the way in a competition.
Following Tuesday's match, Man United head back to the Premier League and the Hawthorns for their Sunday matchup against West Brom. Meanwhile, West Ham's next Premier League match will be against Sheffield United on Monday. And that is all from me for now. Sonny, back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uden. Finally, the sunny side of sports remembers Leon Spinks, who upset Muhammad Ali in 1978 to win the world heavyweight boxing title. Leon Spinks died February 5th at the age of 67. He had battled prostate cancer and other ailments for several years. Leon Spinks won the light heavyweight gold medal at the 1976 Olympics in Montreal, Canada. At those same Olympics, Leon's younger brother, Michael, won the middleweight gold medal. In only his eighth professional fight, Leon Spinks scored a split decision victory against Ali in one of boxing's greatest upsets. Leon Spinks held the world heavyweight title for only 7 months, losing the rematch to Ali in September of 1978. And on Wednesday's show, we'll have commentary from Namdi Hollywood Mueta, our reigning prince of pugilistics, about the late Leon Spinks. And that wraps up the February 9th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.